2020 started with a mystery in Minnesota. Adam Bells of the Minneapolis Star Tribune went to the scene, investigated, and had this report.
Hey there, I'm standing here in Crystal, Minnesota at the scene of a great mystery. There was a picture going around on Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit of corn in train tracks, and many of you didn't believe it was real. I'm not even sure I believed it was real, but it's real. Check this out.
Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. This is the MTOM Podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market Television Show. Glad to have you here. Hey, a note, this is one of those discussions with reporters, but we're going to talk about agriculture in Minnesota and in Iowa and in the Midwest. We're going to get into dairy with Adam Bells of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And we're going to talk about some of the big issues coming in 2020, what he sees from where he covers agriculture as a full-time reporter at that newspaper. And most importantly, we find out what's going on with this corn. We've posted a picture of it on our Facebook and Twitter page, and we'll post it again with this episode. So you can see how did this perfect line of corn end up in these railroad tracks. We don't actually know the real answer yet. Or who was responsible. We just know that the corn was there and it ended up in Crystal, Minnesota. So now, Adam Bells, today, if you have any comments or questions, send them to us at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Give us a 5-star review. Tell a friend. We'd really appreciate it. Now, here's Adam Bells. All right, the big question, Adam, is have you ever been on a search along railroad tracks to find out the source of corn before?
Not before the last week. Last week was my first foray into that sort of forensic investigation.
So like social media, you never know where something comes from. I saw it off of an account in Kansas. Somebody had posted, said, I don't know what the source is. How did you figure out what the source was?
So I had some trouble figuring it out too, because I couldn't figure out who was the original poster of the photo. You know, stuff gets reshared on different platforms, and that's obviously what happened in this case with the corn and the railroad tracks. And a friend of mine in Iowa, actually, Brad Peterson, I think he's still in Iowa. When I knew him, he was in Iowa. He pointed me to the original. He tagged me under the original photo.
Okay,
which was a guy named Mike Parker.
Yep.
Who I sent him a direct message. I said, "Where'd you take this photo? And or did you take this photo? And where?" And he said, "Yes, I took it." And he said, "It's right off of Highway 81 in Crystal." So I drove up there and pulled off into one of the neighborhoods that cul-de-sac into the railroad tracks and climbed up on the tracks. And sure enough, there it was. I was very pleased, as you could see on the video.
Yeah. And the video we've played here, there's certain things that are fun for mysteries when you're sent out, I would imagine. You don't have that many mysteries covering agriculture like that, do you?
No, you don't. I mean, I would say that's the most fun I've had as a reporter in a long time. Yeah. And it's not really a serious story. I mean, it's like $3,000 worth of corn. It's not a big deal, but boy, the pictures were striking, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. My kids got a big kick out of them. I said, "Hey, look what I found on Twitter today," and I showed them, and they were like, "Oh, how'd that happen?" And I enjoyed your math trying to figure out how much corn was actually wasted.
Yeah, kind of a little imprecise, right? But I figured an inch and a half deep, about 2,000 plus feet long and four feet, 8 inches wide. I can't do the math in my head, but what we came out to was like $3,500 worth of corn at corn prices that day.
Right. And we all know that corn prices go up and corn prices go down. And this was one of those days last week.
Yeah,
at that point, it was up. So.
Paul, if this had happened in 2013, it would have been a
huge story. WCCO would have led with it. Jason Duresha in the morning, that's all he would have talked about.
I'm sure, yes.
He enjoys that kind of stuff. He's got an ag background in the state of Iowa, as do you, former reporter at Cedar Rapids Gazette and Des Moines Register. Did you consider the Gazette your hometown paper as a kid?
Yeah, I did. Mostly what I read the paper for as a kid was to track the Hawkeyes. So they did, the Cedar Rapids Gazette did and does a really good job of that. And that's what I considered important.
Sports is the gateway newspaper coverage. You know, it starts with the box score. It mm-hmm. goes to the team coverage. And then before you know it, you're reading the comics and you read Judge Parker.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, we got the Sunday Register. The main thing I wanted to read was the batting averages in the Big Peach. I don't
yeah.
know if you remember
oh,
that.
Oh, the Big Peach. That was the Des Moines Register Sunday paper for decades was actually colored peach, not faded newsprint, but I mean it was peach colored and it had tons and tons of reporters on all the beats. I mean, you would read, they would even send dispatches, reporters to Iowa Conference football on a Saturday, let alone Iowa and Iowa State and you and I and Drake. And that's just not the same media landscape that it once was.
No. You know, I don't want to derail the conversation here, but did you follow like the whole Ken Fusen self-written obituary thing?
Yeah. So a little background here, Ken Fusen, columnist at the Des Moines Register, on and off a couple of different stints, passed away in early January, and I believe he was laid off or he chose early retirement of the Register. I don't know which schematic you want to believe.
I think it's a combination of the two.
You know, here's your opportunity to not get fired, so that's your choice. He wrote his own obituary and published it, and it then was published in the paper, and there's a couple of interesting parts of this. Every dollar matters in media, Adam, as we found. The Register was going to charge the family full price for an obituary to run. And then there was some back and forth. And from my understanding, then it was at least half price or what the former staffer's price. That was one part. And another was... then he published, you know, make sure you eat your fruits and vegetables. He talked about some of the illnesses he had, and one of them was a gambling addiction, and that was something that some people didn't know about him, but if you knew him, you knew it.
Yeah, well, so here's what I wanted to bring up is, you know, Fusen, so 2008 was, I was working at the Gazette, and I applied for a job at the Register. And I think I was going to get it, but then they had this like 10% payroll reduction that they had to do. And then I didn't get it. I didn't get to go to the Register for another 2 years. So in that payroll reduction, Fusen essentially lost his job, right? And he was an incredible writer, a really good reporter. I only met him a couple times. One of the times was when I was at the Gazette. I was sent up to Postville to cover the immigration raid in 2008.
Yeah.
So this is like a couple months before the whole the payroll reduction that the Register did. And I think if you talk to people who worked at the Register then, it's kind of like that was the tail end of the golden age. If you know, if the Big Peach, when they were sending reporters to Iowa Conference football games and, you know, getting Pulitzers for covering like Kansas State football games and all kinds of stuff. If that was like the gilded age, the end of the sort of awesome Register that we had in Iowa was probably 2008 before I even got there. And here's a good example of it. When that raid happened, I'm sure you remember that, right?
Yeah.
That
was Just,
I was driving up from Cedar Rapids to Postville, and Postville was part of our coverage area.
We did
home delivery in that part of the state. But we just did not have the ability to handle a big story the way the Register did. And I remember just every day getting crushed by the Register's coverage. You know, I would go up there by myself, do a sort of passable job of writing something about what happened. And they would have these like incisive, long, thoughtful, well-reported dispatches every day for like the next week. And one of those stories was where I ran into Ken Fusen was there was a kid who apparently didn't have his papers, who was he was a captain of the football team and an honors student, and there was this rumor going around town that he was that there was this kid that met all those criteria. And so I went to the high school to try to find him and just find out his name, and and then write about him. And then I went in and talked to the superintendent, and the superintendent just kind of gently turned me away. As I'm leaving, as I'm leaving the school, in walks Ken Fusen. He's like this, you know, he's this big guy, almost theatrically friendly in person. and he's ushered into the superintendent's office like they are, like they played high school football together, like they were buddies. And 2 days later, so I left empty handed. I got nothing out of it. 2 days later, the front page of the Register, Fusen had a story saying his name is Santiago Cordero. You know, just a beautifully written, off the news story about this kid who was, you know, whose life was upended. His mom was detained as a result of the raid. And that just, you know, so just hearing you talk about the Big Peach reminds me, man, the Register used to be so good. Used to be so good. And, I know there are still people there doing good work, and they have a lot of good habits and a lot of good expectations built into that culture there. But, man, back then there are three people at the Star Tribune who came from the Register right now: Reed Forgrave, Abby Simons, and myself. There may be even more. And a lot of the people who were covering that Postville raid are all over the country now, working at papers like the New York Times. I mean, not the New York Times, the LA Times, Associated Press. Anyway,
they make the jump.
Is over.
But no, and that actually brings up a good point, Adam, because in Minneapolis, the Star Tribune isn't exactly a shabby newspaper. And when you started, are you the only full-time agriculture reporter?
Yes.
So yeah, then when you started, or do you know what the history is of how many reporters they had dedicated to agriculture at your paper?
Well, so there's a food reporter and an ag reporter right now. I'm the ag reporter. The food reporter is Kristen Painter. And the way we break it down is she handles everything from after the cow is killed in the slaughterhouse. It's the point of the cow's death.
Right. It matters.
Yeah. That is the barrier between our beats. So, I mean, in some ways she covers agriculture. So there's two of us. As long as I've been here, that's how it was. That's how there's a food reporter and an ag reporter. There may have been more back in the, you know, 90s or early 2000s, but.
Well, I always kind of keep an eye, always have for a number of years from your time at the Gazette and the Register, always kind of, you know, looked, what's Adam writing this time? And the corn story caught my attention. And I believe you also wrote a story about recently about older machinery and its popularity. Was that yours?
Yes, that was mine.
And we know in this technology age that you can sit in a tractor or a combine and you can watch a show on Netflix and the machine keeps on driving down the road or down the field doing what it needs to do, and you really don't have to operate it like you used to. But there's some that have kind of resisted that for a number of reasons.
Yeah, well, so it's not so much resistance to auto steering, which I think every farmer, well, at least every farmer I've spoken to, agrees is a crucial part of their operation. It's resistance to the machines with so much technology that you can't fix them at all. So you can. So I talked to a guy named Mark Stock who runs Big Iron Auctions out of Nebraska, and I asked him, so what sold a lot? They had a big auction at the end of the year, December 26, 27, sold like 3,000 pieces of machinery. I said, well, what was selling a lot? And he told me two things, one of which was planters. People are buying a bunch of planters because they want to have multiple planters in case there's another wet spring. I did not write about that. I may write about that, yeah.
Yeah.
But the other thing was people are buying old tractors in good condition with low hours. And I thought, huh. And he said these 1977 and 1982 John Deere's are just quality machines. If you find one in good condition, it's a hot commodity on the auction circuit. And the reason is because you don't have to get software codes to fix stuff on it, which is the case with these newer tractors. And at the same time, the people do install aftermarket auto steer, which costs, you know, maybe like $2,000 or $3,000. It can be done for that. And then they have a tractor that can do basically everything they need it to do, and then they can fix it themselves, and they don't have to call the dealership every time a sensor blows. So,
and they're allowed to fix it, right? Because isn't there some cases where you're not allowed? That kind of violates some terms. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it can violate terms. I think the bigger issue is the dealerships and the manufacturers just don't share the information that's needed to fix it. You know, you need special diagnostic software. Even if you buy aftermarket diagnostic tools, that can be expensive and not as reliable as the factory diagnostic tools. So it's a big issue, and I actually wrote another story for Sunday's paper about it. I mean, the one about the old tractors was a huge hit by Star Tribune standards.
Sure.
I think it tapped into a couple things: the whole right to repair movement, also like nostalgia for old tractors. I think people love tractors.
They do.
And
we've done whole shows about them. Yes, I know. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. And then the other thing is there's sort of a product design insight in it that I think Silicon Valley sort of types were interested in. If the technology is not working for the customer, if the technology makes the customer's life more difficult, why are you designing the product that way? So I think it was shared a lot on, you know, technology sort of think piece chat boards and stuff like that. Anyway, it was a big hit. I wrote another story about the right to repair movement, and it's not just tractors, you know. I mean, you know this. It's iPhones, cameras. There's even an example of a Nerf dart blaster made by Hasbro that has sensors in it that don't allow it to shoot aftermarket darts, which are much cheaper on Amazon.
Yeah.
So all kinds of companies are trying to restrict what the customer can do with their product. I think because the margins on the product itself are not so great, and they need to find ways to like build in future revenue when they sell a product. They want to be a platform rather than just a provider of products. And, you know, farmers don't want their tractors to be platforms. They want them to be products.
They want to use them, and they got to get in when that small window happens. Like we saw in 2019, there were very few opportunities for good runs in the planting or in the harvesting, for that matter. How much did you get out and explore around with growers during the 2019 year?
Quite a bit. To get a photographer to just a little inside baseball here, to get a photographer to a farm, it's very much ideal if I talk to a farmer that's within an hour and a half of the Twin Cities.
Sure.
Luckily, there are a lot of farms within an hour and a half of the Twin Cities. So I spent a lot of time in the Northfield area and kind of southwest of the Twin Cities. Big stories. Obviously, the delayed planting was a big story. The high number of acres in prevent plant was a big story. The trade war has been a big story for a year and a half. I've kind of lost track of new ways to write about it, to be honest.
Kind of know what you're – yes, I know the feeling.
So yeah, I always feel like the more – this is an old cliche, but the more I get out and talk to farmers, the more good stories I find. It's a simple matter of just getting out there and beating the bushes. I got to do it more. I got to do it more.
Yeah, we all do, and that's you get the pulse of what's really happening. And one of the things was the dairy industry. That's really always a topic that we cover heavily on our show. And you had a conversation with the Land O'Lakes CEO, and it's been a tough go here lately for dairy producers, whether they're in Iowa or Minnesota or Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'd be interested in your take. I mean, I'm kind of, I don't know, maybe cold-hearted is the way to put it about it. I just don't see what the future is for a small dairy farm. I guess I've been talking to Maren Bozic too much, the milk economist at the University of Minnesota, who always makes everybody angry by saying that scale is the only way forward. But
well,
I just don't see it. I was out at Riverview. Have you heard of them?
No, LLP? I haven't.
Huge dairy in western Minnesota. They have, for a while there, they were building a 7,000 cow dairy every year. And they have these gigantic buildings with 9,000 cows in them, 7,000 that they milk at any given time. I mean, they've got calves coming out of the pens and into like a little bullpen for the calves.
Sure.
Every few minutes, you know, they, they really believe that dairy was the, you know, dairy was the last, will be the last in farm industry to consolidate, and they wanted to be at the, you know, they wanted to be the first mover on that, at least in this region. And they've done that. They can produce milk more cheaply than, you know, 90 farms with a, with 100 cows each or something like that. So I don't know. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, is there, we discuss, you know, scale quite often, and, that is what agriculture has changed, is from small farms. If part of the reason I'm doing what I do is the farm that I grew up on in Buchanan County, Iowa, was not going to be big enough to support me and my father. And, you know, getting land when you're competing against the big operators was a challenge. And, you know, we highlight some stories where people have, you know, they have a varied approach now, not just corn, soybeans, hay. It's, you know what, we do this with our milk, or we do this with our, we grow organic slash this type of corn or this type of product. And finding ways to, if you can't do it by scale, do it by what the market needs. And that's pretty much true in any business right now, is what's your success and how flexible can you be in turning on what is a market need and what you can do within the confines of your labor, whether it's an ag tourism. You know, you think of Hanson Dairy in Hudson, Iowa, just south and I guess west of Waterloo, Iowa, in the northeast part. Years ago, they figured out a way to do sell their milk directly to stores in the area. And then it was, you know, let's do some tours. And, you know, you, agritourism is a business. Is it the only business? But it is an opportunity to market yourself. I mean, let's face it, farmers have got to be marketers now.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know if that really answers your question or not, but I think it, I think you're right in saying it. I think the farm, the small family business in dairy is going to have a hard time moving forward. And I don't know if there's any government programs that's going to be able to solve the answer. Secretary Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, now U.S. Dairy Export Council, you know, he'll tell you, he says, we need to find new markets for our product. And then you get back to the trade story that we've talked about. And I don't know, can you get enough product to demand for your product to get your way out of this so there's enough for everybody that's being produced? It's a lot of cheese.
Yeah,
we
make,
we eat a lot of cheese, but that's not enough to compensate what we drink in gallons. And, you know, they're facing, you know, names of almond milk and soy milk. And how can you call it milk if it's from a nut? I saw something online yesterday. It's like, yes, I was an almond milker. Man, my fingers were tired. You know, I mean, and there's some people think that that's really how it works. But again, agriculture's got to get out and tell its own story.
I like how the milk, sort of the milk advocates I talk to call it nut juice.
Right.
Which is
right.
Not, yeah, you know, obviously not something the almond producers like to call their their product.
No, no, they're not really looking forward to that. So, I mean, we've got Anderson Erickson here, which is a large distributor in the Midwest, and but they are not an exporter to other countries. I'm not familiar enough with all of Land O'Lakes products to know. Do they send anything north or south of the border?
You know, I'm not actually sure of that. I would assume that there's some, they're involved in something, some kind of exporting, but
yeah,
I don't think it's the main part of their what they're doing. I mean, that's another thing is the, you know, like you said, demand for milk is dropping. Cows are producing more milk per cow every year. I don't know, man.
It's a production. It's an overproduction model. And as we keep producing corn, we're really good at it. Look at how good we are, even in a bad year. Look how much corn came out of the report last week.
Right.
USDA, it's like even in a bad year, we still were way above what we were doing 10 or 20 years ago. So we're really good. American farmers are really good at what they do when it comes to production.
Yeah.
They're also having, you know, one of the things that's chewed through a lot of corn over the years has been ethanol and the renewable fuel standard. How much have you been covering that story, saga?
Not much, to be honest. There's an energy reporter who sits across the cubicle wall from me who's been doing some stuff on ethanol. he just, you know, we talk about it sometimes. It seems crazy to me that a third of the corn crop goes to ethanol. And like, how long is, so that's one of the, that's a question I asked Beth Ford after her speech last week. How sustainable do you think, how financially sustainable do you think corn and soybean production is in the long term? You know, given the loss of the market, there's going to be some permanent loss of the Chinese market. I think most people, permanent's a strong word, but some long-term loss of the Chinese market for soybeans. We're doing a third of our corn goes to ethanol, and we don't even know how long vehicles are going to be using liquid fuel, you know? So
right.
She sort of said, well, there's no near term worry about the sustainability of corn and soybeans, but you know, eventually our incentives are going to have to change. And one of those key incentives, aside from subsidized crop insurance, is the, for corn and soybeans, is the ethanol mandates. You know, I mean, it's a huge crutch for corn. Or corn growers.
Well, you have a big group that says the only way this industry has survived and thrived up until this point was because of mandates or government programs. And they're like, well, just let them compete on their own and let's see how it works out. And then the oil people, you know, they're like, and oil says, well, you mean like us? And they're like, well, wait a minute. No, oil's got incentive, you know. And then
right.
You know, you get in the back and forth, the firing time. This week here in Iowa, it'll be the Iowa Renewable Fuels Summit. And that's always a chance to hear national folks come in to Iowa and Iowa folks to talk to members. There's a lot of people who have ownership in some of these ethanol plants and kind of they get a touch on what's going on in the industry. And 4 years ago, there was a presidential candidate who came in and says, I love ethanol. I support ethanol. I'll do everything in my power to keep the renewable fuel standard intact. Well, he's the owner, or he's the one who resides at 1600 Pennsylvania right now. And his EPA hasn't held up what the president keeps telling elected leaders from Iowa specifically. Charles Grassley says over and over again, he says, I'm taking the president at his word that he's going to do it, but then the EPA won't follow through. And
are you talking about with the waivers?
Yeah. And that's what Grassley's been, you know, he's like, I got the word from the president, you know, and I'm going to hold him at his word. But, you know, they just won't criticize on a outward basis on their frustrations with the president, other than, you know, saying you need to keep your word because the word is important out here in rural America.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do the Minnesota politicians talk about ethanol?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I know the waiver issue has been a big frustration up here. I don't know that it's like a top of mind issue, but it's certainly been discussed. And, you know, Tom Peterson, the head of the Department of Agriculture, he's a pretty sharp guy, and he's talked about it, been frustrated by it.
Got Colin Peterson in your state on the House side. He's a, you know, past chair of the House Ag Committee and still a loud voice on many things. What are your conversations with him like?
So I haven't had a ton of conversations with him. You know, we have a robust politics team that spends a lot of time with the delegation at the Star Tribune. But the last time I talked to him was about CRP funding, and I thought it was kind of an interesting conversation because he's pulled in several directions by like the duck shooting lobby. I don't know what is that called?
Pheasants Forever, or Ducks Unlimited.
Yeah, those two groups are all over him, and he, you know, he feels like there should be probably more land in CRP, not just as a conservation measure, but also as like an economic supply control measure. I don't know, you know, how realistic any of that is sort of another question, but the number of acres for CRP has gone up in the last couple of years a little bit, right?
Yeah. And conservation and the environment is something we talk about in Iowa a lot, or we hear about water quality and things like that. And I know that Minnesota, I mean, it's in the name, land of 10,000 lakes. I think water quality is kind of important to the state. How much do you get into that beat?
Some, yeah. I mean, cover cropping, I had a good story on cover cropping in mid-December. And then one story in the fall about how the Zumbro River is really becoming more volatile as a result of the really heavy rainfall that we have now in Minnesota. I assume it's also in Iowa.
We had a little bit.
Yeah. Three, like these mammoth deluges are more common than they used to be. And so there's a bunch of land on the river bottom in the Zumbro River Valley, which is kind of, you know, similar to like Decorah's landscape. And that land is just sort of being reclaimed by the river. But that's not a water quality issue. The cover cropping thing is more related to water quality. And there is some movement towards soil conservation techniques that are a little bit more serious than what farmers have done over the last 50 years here in Minnesota. I found it a really interesting topic to look into, you know, to get to talk to people who are passionate about soil structure and worms. And, I thought it was interesting.
And that is something that, some farmers are really into and some are slow to adopt. I had a professor, he drives from just north of Des Moines to, Mankato, during the fall and winter terms as a professor, and he's big into cover crops. And Lee Testel had said, you know, I look at how many cover crop fields, and usually if there's a cover crop field in my path, I slow down and look at it and kind of make a mental note. Well, I don't remember one being there before. So he's like, they're slow to adapt, both in Iowa and in Minnesota. Is there anything driving the increase?
Well, you know, one of the selling points is that if you have a cover crop and you seed into the cover crop, you have sort of a base that your tractor can drive on in the spring, mm-hmm. and rather than just pure mud. And I don't know, I think there's got to be a few farmers out there who look at the wet spring the last 2 years in Minnesota and say, yeah, I mean, maybe I'll try it. Maybe I'll try to have some cereal rye down so I don't have to wait until June 1st to plant my corn, you know?
That's early compared to what we had in 2019, June 1st.
Yeah, right.
go ahead.
Yeah, no. So I think that drives it. But to your point about like people being slow to adapt it, I think my sense is a lot of farmers, if this message is coming from the universities or the environmental advocates, farmers are just like, nope, not going to listen to that. You know, it's got to come from like other farmers who are making it work before a farmer says, yeah, I'll try that.
The endorsement has to be the neighbor, not the agronomist or extension person who's spent right. their whole career working on this.
Yeah. Writing white papers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. All right. As we close here, what do you see as big issues in 2020 in agriculture from where you sit in Minnesota?
I think, well, the obvious ones are the trade war and everybody's watching the weather. But I think in 2020 and probably all the way through to 2040, a really big issue, one that I want to write some about is farm succession and new farmers, those difficulties that new farmers face in getting started and getting going, the aging farmer population, all those things are, you know, the high land prices, all those things are related and deserve probably more attention and better coverage from me and, you know, the two other ag reporters at Daily Newspapers in America.
It is something that is coming quickly, and some are much better prepared than others and have planned, and the others have not. And it just depends on, we could have a major mess, and it's going to probably have to be a lot of those, the basement meetings where someone goes, well, you know what, I should put this in a trust, or I should be you know, I'm going to have 600 acres and I'm going to let a different farmer farm 100 acres at a time. So I've got six new farmers. You know, I mean, we've done stories like that, and you're seeing more of that. And we'll see how this transition goes from one generation to another.
I gotta check those stories out. You email me some links.
I absolutely will. All right. We'll do that. Adam, I appreciate the time and look forward to reading your stuff here in 2020.
Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show.
Comments, questions, concerns, or potato salad recipes, send them our way at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.